Welcome to Tech Talk by LG. My name is Erik Svalberg and I'm product specialist here at LG Electronics Nordic. I'm fascinated by tech and I enjoy learning about how things work. So this is a podcast where we get to do exactly that. It's about all things tech and we break down different topics and technologies so that you can also gain a deeper understanding of your favorite products and all of the gadgetry around you every day. Welcome to another episode of Tech Talks by LG. And last week, we were at an art gallery setting up an art exhibition. And you might wonder, why would we be at an art gallery? I mean, sure, our TVs look good, but art? Now, don't get me wrong, props to the designers, they've done a great job, but obviously, that's not the reason why we were at an art gallery. No, we were there because this was one of the first art exhibits in the Nordic of NFT art. And obviously, in order to display this digital artwork, they also needed high-quality screens. And that's how we got involved there. It's been really exciting to see. We collaborated with Larsen Werner, a local gallery in Stureplan, if you know the place. And if not, if you're in the vicinity, I really recommend you go have a look. But at the same time, that kind of got me thinking about things like blockchain technology. And I felt I wanted to learn a bit more about that. And since this isn't really a topic that I feel I know enough about, I've actually invited on our show's first guest. So with us today, we have calling in Cecilia Skarp, who I actually know as a former employee from when we both worked here in the service department for LG. But since then, she has moved on to become quite an expert in crypto security and blockchain technology. And Cecilia, welcome to the show. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I have indeed gone from technical troubleshooting and tech education with LG to the cryptosphere. And today I'm a financial investigator and anti-money laundering specialist. I can't code. I must admit that my strengths lie elsewhere. But in 2022, I also had the honor of educating future blockchain developers.
Okay, so help me out a bit here, because I feel that every time I try to research blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies and all of this jazz, I just end up more confused than I was before I started reading about it. And a lot of these buzzwords and terminology feel like they're almost meant to raise the barrier to entry by making it more difficult to understand than necessary. So how about today we try to do the exact opposite?
I have been told that I can explain complex things in a simple way. So let's try to dispel the technobabble that is so prevalent out there. I will start by talking a little bit about different kinds of networks and different kinds of blockchains. Buzzwords that often occur here, so these words that you will see again and again and again, are centralized, decentralized, and distributed. A centralized network is built through one central point of authority. It could be a server if you compare it to computers, or a power plant if you compare it to electricity, where all of the important processes happened. And if this server goes down, the network goes down. So centralized means one point of failure. Decentralized, then, on the other hand, means that there is no single point of failure or one unit that controls it. And distributed, well, that is about the blockchain ledger in itself, about the technology and how every node that is synchronized with a blockchain has a copy of the entire chain. I will explain this a little bit better very soon, but for now I just want you to take with you that if a network is distributed, it's probably also decentralized. So distributed technology can be centrally controlled, for example, of a company or by a state. This could be, for example, a digital central bank currency that is still resting on distributed tech and blockchain technology, or it could be a company using it for logistics, for example.
Okay, so with these different types of networks, I guess one of the big questions is, if this is a place where I keep my money or perhaps even more valuable things, maybe contracts or intellectual property, who else is it being distributed to? How do I know that somebody doesn't remove a zero from my bank account and add it to their own? And how do I know that what's kept there is safe?
There are different kinds of blockchains. They are generally classified as open or closed, depending on how they treat their security and their threat model. They can be open, they can be closed, or they can be a hybrid model. And an open blockchain, which is what I am speaking about primarily today, with NFTs built on Ethereum and how it all started with Bitcoin, is that the open or permissionless blockchains, are called trustless. Not because you cannot trust them, but because trust is not needed. Even bad actors can join these open networks, but honest behavior is rewarded. This is the incentive mechanism that rewards honest behavior among the participants. And when you, on the other hand, is talking about a closed blockchain, these are by many considered more secure because they work in a trusted environment where all of the actors are held responsible through legal terms. There are pros and cons with both of these models, but it's all about the purpose. What are you doing with them, I would say.
Okay, so we've talked a bit about how that network looks and how it's set up, but what are we actually putting out there on the network then?
From a development viewpoint, a blockchain has three layers. These are, from the bottom, the protocol layer, where you specify the rules that are the basis of the entire thing, on top of which you have the network layer that gives access to the blockchain protocol, and on the very top, you run the application layer. When we talk about Ethereum, for example, and NFTs, they are decentralized applications that perform different functions in the top application layer. So how does a protocol change? Because there are developments continuously in this world. And in a closed system that we discussed, the development will, of course, be governed by a central authority, such as a business or a state. And in an open decentralized system, it's done through voting. The developers do not agree, you simply put it out for a vote. How do you want to continue this peer-to-peer network to grow? We talk a bit more about this to explain what Bitcoin and Ethereum is. But I think it's interesting for the listener to know how this all came to be, but also how it grows and changes over time.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess what I'm hearing here is that there's a number of different ways the network can be set up, and there's a number of different functions that can be performed on that network. But before we fall into the same trap of incomprehensible technobabble, and I know that you have a lot of other things that you want to get into on just how this stuff works and how it gets started and, you know, just where it all came from. But before we go there, pause for a bit so that you can give us sort of a final definition of what is the blockchain. Why do we call it a blockchain? What are these blocks?
To try to answer the question of what a blockchain actually is, I will refer to the design of it and say that in the case of a decentralized blockchain, it's a distributed database where transactions of data, information, or cryptocurrencies are organized and packaged into blocks. Each of these blocks is chained to or linked to the earlier block through something called a cryptographic hash function. So the name of the blockchain, it comes from how the technology is built. Modifications of the chain can be discovered and prevented. This means that every block can be traced all the way back to the very first block in the chain.
Okay, so every data block is linked to one another, and you can't really tamper with one of them without it somehow being noticed throughout the entire chain. And if you were to, say, add a fake coin, it wouldn't really make any sense because everybody could see that it's fake. That does kind of make it an interesting alternative to things like trusted institutions where you would trust banks or government to instill value in a currency. Here instead, the trust and value is based on the fact that everybody can see it and there's no way to lie about it. And if, let's say, whatever market forces decide that a Bitcoin is worth whatever it's worth, then each individual Bitcoin can also be trusted because there's no way to fake one. Okay, so then we know sort of why each item on the blockchain can have that individual value. So where does that initial value come from? What else do we need?
Let's move on to what I find even more interesting. How did it all come to be and why does it matter? So an open blockchain has five key components, and these are the validation rules, the network, the ledger, the consensus mechanisms that make sure that honest behavior is rewarded, and the cryptography. That's what I mentioned with the hash function that makes sure to comprise huge amounts of data in a very efficient way that cannot be tampered with, but contains all of the data from the full chain. So I won't go into detail about cryptography, I'll spare you the heavy mat, but I will say that I find it always fun to be able to say that no, it's not cryptic, it's cryptographic, even if it definitely may seem very mystical and hard to deal with when one first encounters this area. So I'd like to explain the consensus mechanisms here, Because a lot of people ask me about, well, how does it work? How are, for example, new Bitcoins generated? So I would like to discuss the two most common consensus mechanisms, proof of work and proof of stake. In proof of work, also known as mining for Bitcoin, the actors in the network solve complex mathematical puzzles that require a lot of computing power. Whoever is first with solving the problem is rewarded with a block and a predetermined amount of Bitcoin that keeps halving at a set amount of years, which is why Bitcoin has a preset amount of Bitcoin that ever will be produced. It is theorized to be a protection against inflation. The mining is part of a network where the actors compete against each other to solve complex mathematical puzzles. Once you can figure out what's called the nonce of a block, this stands for number used only once, but whoever is first with figuring out what this value, what X is rewarded with Bitcoin and gets to create the next block that is accepted by the network. We can compare this with proof of stake. This is nowadays used by Ethereum in Ethereum 2.0 that have transferred from proof of work to proof of stake. In this system, the creator of the next block is not determined by figuring out a nonce or a complex puzzle. Instead, it's your stake. How much Ether do you have? Or how long have you held it? That will give you an increased chance to become the validator of the next block and be qualified to add a new block to the Ethereum 2.0 blockchain. Here you're not rewarded with the new minted coins, but instead you get all of the transaction fees in the block, for example. And there are many, many kinds of validation rules. You can make a consensus mechanism in a lot of ways that already exist, and probably a lot more that I cannot even imagine at the time. But the point of it is to reward honest behavior among the participants in an open blockchain.
Okay, so basically the people who are invested in this blockchain are going to participate in creating the next link in the chain, and they can be invested either by basically putting in the work, although I guess it's work in the sense of building these extravagant mining rigs that we've heard about and then having them compute just massive amounts of data, or they are simply that heavily invested, that highly participant in whatever is on the blockchain. And that's sort of how they earn the right, so to say, to build the next link. I mean, just to bring it down to earth and cut a bit of the lingo down.
So I'll stop here because you as a listener really do not need to understand all the ins and outs of electricity or the internet to benefit from using them. And it's really the same with blockchains. The point of all of this is that blockchain technology is very useful whenever you're handling massive amounts of securely encrypted data. And to summarize what I've talked about and tie it up neatly before we transition and talk cool real use cases, I would like to just describe all of this in an example. And I will do so in the form of the transaction. Because here you get that all of the things that I have mentioned, the components, you can see how they act together to make a transaction happen. So a transaction starts, it's initiated by someone, and it is announced to the network of nodes or participants. These nodes use algorithms to validate the transaction and the user status of whoever transmitted this transaction they wish to make a transaction. Once it is verified, it is now added to a new block of data. The new block of data becomes a part of the permanent blockchain and the transaction is finished. So it all started with the very first Bitcoin transaction and the first block called the Genesis block of Bitcoin. Besides the world's 51st Bitcoin, it contained the message of the Times 03rd of January 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. The message here, it refers to an article in the newspaper The Times, and it matters because it proves that it was made on that same day, and the block couldn't have been made earlier, and Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, or they may be, did not have any pre-mined Bitcoin blocks at hand. And then we have the very first purchase, which I find a funny anecdote, because on the 22nd of May 2010, a programmer named Laszlo offered 10,000 Bitcoin for two pizzas. On this date, it was worth about 41 USD. I don't have it in my head what the 10,000 Bitcoin is worth today, but I would dare to bet that Laszlo, who made this post, might have regretted it. And I think it's a great example of the so-called hodl philosophy, meaning hold on for dear life, which is a quite common philosophy in the Bitcoin sphere. The Bitcoin blockchain was first, but it also means that its technical capabilities are somewhat limited as it comes to meet the demands of executing certain functions. And that's how we get to Ethereum. They both have in common that the ecosystem has multiple types of actors in them, and no government or specific company controls Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's instead the thousands of nodes, computers, or users around the world that keep the networks running 24/7 all year round. But the difference lies in, besides the use of a different consensus mechanism, as we discussed in proof of work versus proof of stake, is that there are some technical differences in the structure of the blockchains. To say the engine isn't exactly the same. The Ethereum blockchain has some properties that Bitcoin lacks. We saw Bitcoin come alive in 2009, and in 2015, Ethereum entered the stage. Ethereum is a blockchain with its own transaction, but also has many other tokens that are registered and used on top of the Ethereum blockchain. This is the very core of decentralized applications and NFTs. I'll talk a little bit more about those and try to answer like what is a fungible token and what's a non-fungible token that it stands for. But let's stick to Ethereum for now, for you to understand like where we reach a point where you can go to NFT art exhibitions. What you need to know is that the programming language for Ethereum is written in such a way that you can make your own little programs and run it on top of Ethereum. There are different standards for all of these, and NFT is just one of them. So what's meant with a smart contract? If we boil it down to the very core, it's an automated function that says that if A, then B happens. It's also tightly connected to something called DApps, which means decentralized applications. They are much more common, getting more common by the day, and it means that they use blockchains for the data storage and smart contracts for their app logic. And the way I see this, it can change existing business models or invent completely new ones. In one sentence, it allows code to transmit business deals or transactions. So the difference between an application and a DApp, a decentralized application, is that the DApp runs on an open blockchain. It's also open for everybody to review, and they are governed by the logic of the smart contract, not of an individual and not of a company. I don't know if you find this thrillifying. Is it a thrill or is it terrifying? But I find it really cool, personally.
Well, I guess the idea of everything being open to everyone and completely open source, I mean, there is a sense of unregulated anarchy here, which I'm sure a lot of us enjoy and might also find a bit frightening. But at the same time, like you say, it is thrilling to think of this, I guess, removal of oversight in a system that can somehow still be regulated and safe by the very nature of its existence. It's almost a utopian notion in a way, right? But if Ethereum is a programming language and a platform and it's got all these apps running on it and contracts, where does the currency come in? Because I guess that's what we've all heard about, Ethereum the coin.
So on top of the Ethereum blockchain, you use Ether, shortened ETH, which is the currency of the Ethereum blockchain, but it's also the fuel to drive smart contracts on the Ethereum platform. These smart contracts have their own so-called tokens or coins, and you can say that they are created or minted by making a transaction that creates new tokens within the smart contract or whatever logic the programmers decided will generate new tokens. One of these programs that you can run on Ethereum is called ERC-721, and this is the non-fungible token standard. So a fungible token, that would be, for example, one Ether, one Bitcoin, one Dogecoin, or whatever you like to use here, where one unit is replaceable with another unit. A non-fungible token, on the other hand, is associated with a certain digital or physical asset, and this is what separates it from a fungible token. So the ownership of an NFT, non-fungible token, is registered in the blockchain and can then be transferred by the owner, which makes that NFTs can both be sold, used for business transfers, and they can prove ownership of this specific thing, whatever it may be.
I guess actually in this context, the existence of something like NFT art is a very fitting phenomenon in the sense that it kind of draws the same parallels as you have in physical art with mass production. Let's not get into Andy Warhol though. But for example, the reason why you would value a painting over the mass-produced print of that same painting is because one of them is not interchangeable. In fact, maybe an even better parallel would be if you go to a gallery when there is a photo exhibit. And sure, that photo might be printed on t-shirts and posters. And let's say you buy that original print, the one that is in the gallery, and that is something unique. The artist never sold another copy of that photo. In fact, the artist vowed never to make another copy. But then a digital copy ends up with the editor of a book about art, and as part of the marketing for that book, they print a gigantic, really high-quality print of that photo, hang it up in a bookstore. Now, let's say that the quality of that print is equal to the piece of art that you bought, but if, as in the blockchain, everybody knows that it's not the real thing, then everybody will also agree that it doesn't really have the same value, which is odd, because it's really just based on the common agreement that the original is not interchangeable. And as everything that happens on the blockchain needs to be left open to common scrutiny, you're also safeguarded against even the attempt of forgery because it just wouldn't make sense. I mean, if somebody was trying to make a forgery of a painting but had to paint it with everybody watching, it wouldn't really get very far trying to sell that as the original. And I can kind of already see how this could be applied to other things than just art.
Cryptocurrencies are cool and all, but what I personally am really passionate about is the real-life applications of blockchain technology. Some of these, off the top of my head, especially as we just spoke about NFTs, is ownership. Could be the chassis number of a car showing that you own this car and now it changed to this person, because it can still register through an NFT, for example, that this is the specific car, and then it's publicly lodged. Anybody can see that the car changed ownership. It can, of course, be direct online payments. Huge amounts are used for remittance, for example, from people in rich countries working and sending money over to their poor relatives. It fuels DeFi, which stands for decentralized finance. In my opinion, this is a natural development of the smart contract. It can, for example, offer personal loans or complex investment instruments without the need of human administrators. It can be used for logistics and supply chains. It's already used in this way today, but I believe that we'll see so much more of it going forward. And imagine that you can make any kind of traditional contract in digital form. Insurances, renting cars, renting apartments, you name it. I foresee that as we see that AI language models get smarter and we have smart contracts, a lot of bureaucratic services, I believe, are at risk in the future. We also have the area of copyright, which I find really funny because it seems logical that why would you pay to own an NFT? Just copy the picture, take a screenshot, like just make a copy. But the point is that it's non-fungible. You can't fake it, you can't make another one of it. So no matter what you do with it or who made it, you will be absolutely sure of where it originates from. And I believe that this can be a super valuable tool in the future for ownership and proof of ownership. And even if it's mainly used for speculation and creativity today, I foresee a boom. Other areas that we see growing quickly is Web3 and what's called GameFi. Web3 is a decentralized online ecosystem and an idea about the new kind of World Wide Web, built on blockchain technology and a token-based economy. This is closely tied to GameFi, which stands for Game Finance, and is something you often see in play-to-earn games, where players get financial incentives. So the GameFi ecosystem, it uses cryptocurrencies, NFTs, and blockchain technology to create a virtual gaming environment with its own economy. We have also seen virtual fashion grow quickly, where NFT tokens can be used as the embodiment of a product in the digital world. For the time being, it's mainly for luxury accessories such as rare sneakers or watches, so that you can flex your things both in real life and online. But I foresee that this could grow. So, for example, if you are a clothes designer, you can get an enormous audience for your creations if you work in the Web3. And consumers get both a receipt and a proof of authenticity for their product and a cool outfit for their MMO game or in the metaverse. I also think that NFTs, the non-fungible property of them, that they can't be replaced with anything else, can be a great way to combat falsification in the art world, for example. It can be used for ticketing system. And if we're talking blockchain technology by and large, we see it used in a myriad of ways in research. And I also think that it can be a useful tool from a justice perspective in the way that it can provide banking systems to the unbanked that might not have access to the traditional system for whatever reason. And it can be used for electronic identification, making sure that people can access services, prove who they are, without having to travel far, but maybe only through the access of a smartphone and having an internet connection.
Wow, it's really fascinating to think all of the possible applications of this. And I guess, you know, I'm still young enough, I hope, to see where this leads, at least in the near future. So it's going to be really interesting. But we're running a bit short on time now, so I just wanted to ask you one last thing, because we keep hearing about these crypto scams and how Bitcoin is used to buy drugs and all manner of black market, dark web stuff. What is the real situation like with, let's say, blockchain shenanigans?
Thank you so much for asking this question. It genuinely is one of my favorites because the reply often blows people's mind. We are very well aware of cryptocurrency having a PR problem. Let's not pretend otherwise. I'll absolutely let the audience draw their own conclusions about why that may be, but the fact is, and the hard data tells us, that only 0.24%, not 24, but 0.24% of all cryptocurrency transactions were suspicious, according to the world's leading company for blockchain analysis. This data is from the 2023 Crypto Crime Report, and it has gone up from 0.14% in 2022, but the majority of this is sanction evasion following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It may absolutely seem like it, but please do not be fooled into thinking that blockchain technology and traditional finance are opposites or even enemies. Even banks use blockchain technology, and the difference is that the banks work with centralized financial technology, such as through Ripple Laboratories currency Ripple. It's also known as XRP, that was developed in 2012 to replace the SWIFT transfer method. And this is used for banks' internal transfers. So the difference actually only lies in centralization versus decentralized peer-to-peer system that lets the users act as their own banks.
All right, and I think that's actually a great point to end on. The often mistrusted blockchain technology seems to be entirely built on reliability and trust. And perhaps it's not as scary as many people out there would think it is. And I mean, my daughter just turned 8, and I've seen her for the last year already spending her allowance on digital assets in virtual environments for online use. Perhaps to this generation that's coming up now, there won't be the same barrier to entry because it'll simply be more natural to them. Not like us dinosaurs who grew up in a world where movies were still stored on physical media and people bought things with metal coins. Jesus. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for helping us dispel the techno babble. And even though this might actually be our longest episode yet, I know we've barely scratched the surface.
I hope I made somebody a little bit curious and inspired to learn more about it. And I would like to thank you so much for having me.
Well, you definitely left me more curious than I started out, so that's one. But I'm sure I'm one of many. Cecilia, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for being here and holding us by the hand as we walk through this complex, complicated, and fascinating topic. And for all you curious listeners out there, if you want another Tech Talk, I do apologize. We will be taking a short break, but I will be back in a few weeks with another episode and another Tech Talk. So make sure you like, subscribe, follow, whatever it is on the platform you're on, and keep your eyes open, keep your ears open for the next Tech Talk from LG.